It's your girl Jenny Russell. Welcome to another week and part two of what is going to be a three-parter for Hale Health and Happiness. How you doing? Now remember, we are the leading and only radio station that looks at all aspects of health. All aspects of health. And we are available on podcasts, we are available on all platforms that you receive your information. Smartphones, tablets, computers, whichever way. But I've got so much to cover. I cannot even get Lisa, the whole of Lisa, into this show, because even if I did not have to share this interview on chronic pulmonary, obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD, I still couldn't fit it in. So it's a three-part show, but I know that our time is going to be so fast spent, so I don't want to spend too much time talking, and I want to get straight into part two of Lisa and then make space for Professor Michael Crooks. But before I do that, I just want to remind you that I hope, like me, you to remember you are blessed and highly favoured, a magnet for miracles, the solution to someone's problem, and the answer to somebody's prayer. And honestly, what Lisa's sharing this week, I really believe will be an answer to prayer. And then I'm going to take a part of that away and save that for next week, so we have the actual climax for next week. But also, just for those people that have any respiratory issues, COPD is a major respiratory issue for many, many people. And even if we look at the size of the population of this country versus the amount of people, it's still a big proliferation. And if you are a COPD sufferer, then hopefully this information will be of use to you. But we have moved into December. We are in the last month of 2024. So what does your reflection look like? What are you looking for yourself? And what are you hoping to have? What are you worried about? Where are you finding yourself? Do you have these ideas and these dreams of where you want to go? And you can close your eyes and see yourself there, but your inner world tells you something different. Because that inner world really dictates what's going to happen and what's going to come to you. But we'll discuss that next week. So I've got to go straight in because I've got a lot to pack in and I don't have the time to pack it. So without further ado, I want to play a trail now and get straight into Lisa. Part two.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
If optimising your health and well-being is on your to-do list, then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one supplement brand, help you put back what life takes out. All-in-one comprehensive formulas created to offer you maximum benefit, whatever stage of life you're at, and with a range that supports everything from immunity, energy, cardiovascular health, joints, cognitive function, menopause, and even beauty. We've got you and your family covered. Premium ingredients packed into a powerful daily sachet. Simply mix with water to activate for a flavorful health drink. Perfect at home or on the go. Revive Active. Available at selected Holland & Barrett stores, Well Pharmacies, and online at Amazon and reviveactive.com. Super supplements for a super you.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens, and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
We are back. We are back. See, I'll tell you, this could not be a 25. You know, sometimes you meet some people and you think this is going to be, but I'm telling you, we're going to start doing different podcasts. We're going to start doing Instagram lives. We're going to start sharing, because we've got a journey that we have to do. We've got to do some kind of a road show. Yeah. That's what we're going to have to do. But anyway, we're back. So you had mentioned to me when I'd forgotten to press to record, we won't go there, that the reason why they didn't want to give you a stitch is because they put it at the base of the cervix, right?
Yeah.
And when they did their examination, the cervix was closed. But what is it with your cervix that they missed?
Right. So if you can imagine like a balloon, okay? I don't know if you can see this, but if you can imagine this, pretend this is my cervix. So what happened was, so normally...
So she's bringing her two fingers together, because remember, this is radio, yes?
Okay,
two fingers together, and where you'd put your thumb and index finger together. So obviously where the tip of your thumb and index finger, where they're touching at the top, that's what we're talking about.
Yeah. So if you kind of press your thumb and your finger together, you'd have probably about maybe almost an inch where they are flattened together. So you can imagine that's the end of your cervix. So typically what you find is that the cervix will open from the very bottom. So they'll place where your fingernails are. So they'd place a stitch around that. But for me, so when they scanned me, they just checked, I guess, the bottom of the cervix, all right? But for me, mine was opening within the inner cavity of the cervix. So what was happening was the sac was falling down into, so if you can imagine a balloon, right? You blow that or put water in the balloon, and then you have the weight of the water at the top end of the balloon where you've tied it, right? So the sac will just rupture because it's fallen down into an open cavity which should be pinned together. So that's the reason why my waters had ruptured. But you need the amniotic fluid around the baby to obviously
protect
the baby to grow and to protect it from you know, bacteria and things like that. So that's when my son was born, and when he was in the incubator, we were advised that he had black spots in his brain. That was obviously contributory to him being starved of oxygen. So had he survived, he very likely would have been brain damaged. And you know, Jenny, it was at that time when my son was in NICU. No, sorry, when I was actually in hostel, that I had met up with my friend that you'd actually met on the panel. I hadn't seen her in a number of years. And she got in contact with me, and she's God-fearing. She came to a hospital, she brought oil, we blessed the baby, we placed it on his incubator, she brought me a Bible, we read scriptures to him. And it really supported me during that time, because it was a dark period for me. It was a really dark period for me, because I just felt like, how is it? I've tried so hard to do this, and it's other people around me are flawlessly getting pregnant and having beautiful, healthy babies. And I'm trying with every ounce of my being. And each step, there's a challenge, you know? And what's really interesting, the day before my son passed, I'd been driving up to hospital because you can only stay in hospital for about a week. And then they literally boot you out, right? Because they need the space, of course. So having had a C-section because he was born by emergency cesarean, I'm having to drive up to the hospital, you know, every single day. I've got to express milk because my
body... Which you're not supposed to be doing when you're doing that, because that's a lot of pressure across the lower abdominal wall, but yeah.
Exactly. So I'm going up there every day. I'm feeding him by his tube. And I remember on this particular day, the day before he died, I had built my relationship with God, and I said, God, I can't do this anymore. I was tired, Jenny. Because when they're in a new neonatal departments, you go into the room and you've got, like, if you can imagine, you've got 8 incubators, right? 4 on each side. You've got all these parents sitting beside their babies, willing their babies to live. And the machines are blinking and they're beeping and they're doing all sorts of stuff. You've got an amazing team there that look after everything. But the babies constantly need some kind of support. So you leave that neonatal unit, you go home, and you don't know whether or not you're going to get that phone call to say that your baby died during the night, you know, which could happen. So throughout that 2-month period, I wasn't sleeping. I was exhausted. And I remember I prayed to God and I said, God, if you're going to take my son home, then take him, you know, because I'm tired now. But if you're going to leave him, I just pray that you just leave him whole. And that was my prayer. The very next day, my husband said to me, Sam, I'll come with you to go to hospital today. We kind of walked into the unit, and there was nurses around his incubator. And they were trying to get his breathing tube into him, which they've done before. But this time they were being a little bit more aggressive because they were struggling to get it in. And I remember, because I said to God as well, like, if you are going to take him, don't let him die on his own. Let us, as his parents, be there with him. Literally, I don't know, it felt like being in there for 5 minutes, and I heard one of the nurses say, "We're losing him." And I just said to them, "Give me my baby." And he died in my arms.
Wow. That's like, that makes me want to cry. That's a powerful story. So, oh my gosh, Lisa, that is such a powerful story. So, you know, mentally, emotionally, you know, how do you recover from that? And how did you, I mean, one of the things you also said, like you said, they missed that. And I was saying to you that, you know, people can't see this, but I've got this pelvic floor model that I have shared on my Instagram page before at Pelvic Secrets. Lisa, what's your Instagram handle?
It's Lisa Marie _ skincare. So Lisa spelled LEIGHSA Marie, MARI _ skincare.
Wonderful. So I have this little model, pelvic floor model, and I will turn this into little some YouTube shorts as well. And what I was saying to you is that you've got to think that this is literally, this is the gateway that links that inner and outer world. It lines the pelvic basin. And you've got to think that, you know, the bladder's at the front, the bowel's at the back, and the uterus is kind of in between, acting like a buffer between the two. Mm-hmm. So there's not much space in with all of these organs. So it's very easy to nick something, touch something, prod something, and create another problem. So whilst they're fixing one issue, they may create another. So they told me that I have, HPV, and I've had that in my system for, you know, over 30 years. And a couple of years ago, they said, right, you've got some abnormal cells and they're kind of transitioning and we want to, it's called a leap surgery. We sort of burn them off. So when I went for this surgery 2 years ago, they said to me, well, you know, you're 59 now, you don't need your service anymore. So we'll just take the whole lot out. I was like, whoa, stop. Because I know it's my orgasmic collector. I know it's the bodyguard, so to speak, for my uterus. I know that my bladder's attached to it. So I know it plays a number of, you know, postural roles, stability roles, protection roles. So I know that I need to keep this thing here, you know? So they just burnt off a millimeter. It's not that deep in it. They took a tiny millimeter off. But then they told me I had to, then they sort of burn it to seal it. And they told me I had to stay at home and just rest for like a couple of weeks and I'd be fine. But I felt they're swearing at me, like, you can't play tennis for like 3 weeks. I'm just like, did they just swear, you know? Best friends. But a week later, my son, well, about 4 or 5 days later, I'm upstairs, sitting on my bed, just working on my iPad. My son is in his, he's downstairs working from home, was doing hybrid working then. And then I go to the toilet just to empty my bladder. And I just felt this thing fall out. And I just thought it was my cervix. Because, like, I didn't know what it was. The whole toilet was red. But I put like gloves on and I fished this out of the toilet and put it into a bowl. I followed my friend, but my friends were busy. So I got a taxi because my son doesn't drive. I got a taxi to Barnet Hospital and we sat there and I had it in this bowl and we just sat there because, you know, I started to panic, like, oh my God, you know, my insides are falling out, you know?
Yeah.
And it's quite a big picture. I did share it. And then when we got there, we sat in the taxi, I was fine. But as soon as I got out of the taxi and I had these sort of baggy tracksuit bottoms on, they were sort of baggy at the top, but they kind of tapering at the bottom. So black ankle boots, whatever. But when I got to the hospital, as soon as I stepped out of the taxi, I just felt this bloop, bloop, bloop. I was like, what the hell is that? You know, we go in, this is of course during this stupid season, and they wouldn't let my son come in. Imagine you're there, your mum is bleeding out and you're being told you can't come in. So they let him check me in, but there was one person in front of me. And so we were waiting, and whilst we were waiting, I was standing there that the hospital was packed. So I can make little jokes like you do as well. And I just said, this is the way in which you get to jump the queue. So whilst I was standing there, all of a sudden, it was like a tsunami of blood clots. There were blood clots. And they just started to come out and they just started bleeding all over the floor. That same man that said my son couldn't come in, I've never seen him run so fast. He had to run so fast. Mm-hmm. And they got me in and they had it was on the side like yourself. They hadn't sealed it properly. So what they thought they'd done, they sealed, but actually they hadn't sealed it properly. I was going to try and show you a picture. It's quite gruesome.
Wow.
Yeah, and so I had these big, massive blood clots. That's how I found out my blood type. Literally, I lost so much blood, they were going to do a blood transfusion and everything. So, you know.
Oh, wow.
That was just one of it. I mean, I had tons of them like that, and some even bigger than that. They just started to just, and you can just, the thing is, you just feel them coming down the vaginal cavity and, just, and all down in my trousers, socks, my boots. It was very scary. I have to say, I was scared. They got a gynecologist to come down, and then we just started talking about what I do. So we had this whole conversation. But again, they don't understand it as well as they do. But and now our time's gonna be fast spent. So how did you then segue into and suddenly realize that your products were contributing to where you find yourself? So after you've had these two things here, and we're gonna have to do more than one interview. We have to talk about the mental emotional journey that you took as well. But what made you realize that there was, you know, there was something to be had in the hair care products and the skincare products that you were putting on yourself with fertility?
I think I got to the point where I was just tired of not having my questions answered. You know, I'm asking professionals the questions and they're shrugging their shoulders and either give me wishy-washy responses or telling me that they don't know. So I then just started to do my own research to understand, you know, what causes cysts, well, the cysts I kind of like took, you know, the advice from a Chinese herbalist who mentioned about dairy. And I kind of went a step further and, you know, adjusted my diet even more by going fully plant-based. But in terms of the fibroids, I was like, no, these things can't just end up in my womb and I not know, because I wasn't taking contraception. So we know that that's one of the causes, all right? So, just through doing my research, I then learned that the relaxers that I was using in my hair,
because I go
on my scalp, it's going to go into my bloodstream, endocrine disruptors, as you'd mentioned earlier when we weren't recording, when we were talking about, you know, estrogens, you know, and it's what's in our environment. I was a sticker for Palmer's cocoa butter and all those, you know, the Nivea's and all those thick creams that we were using before. But it's only until I was doing my research and learning about, as you mentioned, you touched on as well, about perfumes. These things have parabens, phthalates. They've got all these ingredients in them that are actually endocrine disruptors. They cause your hormones to be imbalanced. And when you become too estrogen dominant, then you end up having inflammation. And then if I'm stressed out at work and I'm not sleeping and I'm, you know, using my phone, so I'm just constantly around radiation. And I just got to the point where I was like, I need to just change my lifestyle. I was learning so much about even the electromagnetic frequencies and things that come from our...
That's right. Because there's six different types of stresses, right? And that's what a lot of people don't realise. So you've got the electromagnetic stresses, the EMFs. You've got chemical stresses. You have environmental stresses. You have thermal stresses, that's our body's internal body heat. You have emotional stresses and you have nutritional stresses. So when you start to recognise, when you start to learn these things, this is what I teach in my workshops. When you start to dig deep into what health really means and you start to understand it from that perspective, you know, stress, if you've got prolonged elevated levels of stress hormone, your body will sacrifice your sex hormones and your repair and restore and rebuild and refresh hormones. It just has to flush these hormones out, right? But people always think of stress as just in the physical, like, you know, I'm not stressed. But if you're a person that reacts, if you're quite reactionary behind the wheel of a car, you're stressed, mate. And when you start to do that, you start to change your breathing. And when you either hyperventilate or hold the breath, the body responds like it's dying inside. So you acidify the body. And cysts, polyps, fibroids, they like to exist in an environment that lacks oxygen. And once you're holding the breath or hyperventilating, it means you're just breathing from the chest. And so the oxygen isn't getting to the base of the lungs. Your nutrition is carried around in the blood, pushed around by the oxygen. So anything below the belly button takes longer to heal. And anything below the belly button for where the baby starts and its journey in life will be starved of the nutrition and the vitality that it needs to get there. But when you don't recognize the environmental stresses, right? So you mentioned you were smoking, so you don't recognize the environmental stress. When you don't recognize the chemical stresses, so just the parabens, if you're eating non-organic, a lot of people are eating non-organic. So the herbicides, the pesticides that are on the that they put onto the foods, the quality of the foods, the quality of the soil, stripped of its vitamins and minerals. Then you start to look at, of course, it's proliferation of electromagnetic field generation. So from the TV to the phone to the iPad to the computer, and the way in which it takes away the melatonin and increases the cortisol, you're not realizing that all of these little habits you're having are having an impact on your hormonal system and your sex hormones in particular. So what was your biggest driver and trigger, and what have you noticed since you have, you know, started to develop your own products? How did you get into developing your own? Let's go through part two for sure. How did you get into developing your own products? What was the driver behind it? How did you get to do it? You know, and what have you found since?
Yeah, so I, as I mentioned, I do my research and I kind of learned so many things. And I think at the time I was like, I wanted to do everything at once, but obviously you don't do it in stages, right? And I was like, okay, well, my skin is my largest organ. How would I start here? I stopped relaxing my hair immediately. And then I started looking for clean skincare that was suitable for my skin type. Not like, you know, the thing that's going to last me an hour and my skin's going to be drying. And I wanted something that's going to moisturize my skin, but also like nourish my body. Couldn't find anything. So then I started just playing around with ingredients and doing research around what oils and butters and things would be beneficial and what essential oils would support me. So I started making my own products because I was still trying to get pregnant naturally, right? And then my family...
How old are you at this time as well?
Say again, sorry?
How old are you at this time, if you don't mind me asking?
Oh, by this time, I'm in my 40s, late 30s, 40s, I'd say, around my 40s. And that's the thing, yeah, in my 40s, because that's at that point you start thinking your clock is literally about to stop any point soon, you know, your maternal clock. So, yeah, I began making my own products. My family were like, what's your skin looking so good? Hang on a second. Make me some. Then I started making it for them. Friends and family got, well, friends got wind of it. I began making it for them. And I was very intentional about using clean products, using really high-grade essential oils. Because, Jenny, I know that you will know that sometimes it says essential oil and it could be 5% of essential
essentially
oil.
Nothing. Yeah, essentially nothing.
Yeah, exactly. So I was really intentional about the ingredients that I was using. And I found that it was really helping, you know. And so that's, it's only when other people started talking to me about it. And actually, by the time I got to my 40s, even though I hadn't spoken to people about doing IVF, I kind of shied away from sharing. I was very reluctant to do so because I was embarrassed at the fact that I couldn't conceive. By the time I got to my 40s now, I'd started to have a couple of conversations and saying, you know, or this is what I'm doing for this, and this is what I've learned about for that. And did you know relaxers cause this? And, you know, perfumes, particularly, you know, you spray them on your thyroid, it's going to cause you a bit of, you know. And people were really interested. And I was so surprised by that. And then I started sharing my journey. And, you know, I've had people ask me, you know, how do you bury a baby? You know, there's so many different things that I was being asked. I was like, okay, well, what are you using your skin? And did you know? And they knew nothing. So I was like, okay, cool. How would I share what I'm doing, you know? And it just transpires that I had begun kind of doing it on a wider, share my products a bit wider field. But last year, September, I got made redundant from the investment bank that I was working for. And everyone was like, now is the time. Now is your
time.
Now is
the time.
Get those products out there. And so having tried and tested it on so many people, and I'd been to markets and fairs and things, I knew it was the right time. And people were interested, and they are interested. And, you know, I've had so many great testimonials. I use Clary Sage, which is a phenomenal essential oil. Geranium, these are great oils for balancing hormones. Lavender, as we know, is you know, to help kind of relax your body. And that's in essential oils, just in one of my body butters. And not only is it helping to support people's like hot flushes, people who are menopausal, finding that it's calming down their hot flushes. Those that are still having periods, finding that they're not having not as painful periods. And the thing is, it's not an overnight fix, right? You've got to be using the products to really let it kind of get into your system and help your liver to start, you know, cleansing from all the other toxins that you've been putting into it. And yeah, we've had people, I've even had, you know, a situation where there's been babies who've had eczema and children have had eczema. They've used my products because there's no toxic products in them, right? And particularly for the baby, had a small, minute amount of lavender just to kind of help calm the baby down a bit. And within 2 days, the parents had seen, because they'd been using steroids before and the steroids weren't working on her skin. 2 days, they'd seen that her skin was improving by a week. They said, I don't know what you got in this stuff, but it healed the baby's eczema. So
do you sell them on a website? Do you have them on your own website? You know, yeah. are you going to try and take them to market, or what are you going to do with them? What's the goal? What's the vision?
So the vision is, I do have them on the website now. And so I'm still going to fairs and markets, but I do have them on a website. My aim is actually to get into stores. I was thinking I would have loved to kind of, just, you know, just to appeal to the spas and the retreats and all that kind of thing. But I think actually it's a product. It's not just for women. I've got different scents. I've got foot oils. I've got castor oil packs. Because as you know, Jenny, castor oil is phenomenal. It's one of those great oils that really gets into cellular, to the cellular level. And I've infused it with turmeric and black pepper and ginger, kind of help with the inflammation, but also to get the blood flowing. So yeah, there's a few products on my site that, you know, I'd love people to, you know, check out. And we get
results. And that's lisamarie.com?
It's lisamarie.com.
LEIGHSAMARI, which is Lima Echo Indigo Golf Hotel Sierra Alpha, mother, I say mother rather than Mike, Alpha Romeo India, yeah, for those of you that just need that letter, that alphabet. So I love doing that.
Yeah, that's the one. There's definitely a product for everyone there. And I also use violet glass, which means that I don't use all those preservatives. This violet glass is really immense at kind of like keeping all the ingredients, you know, prolonged, so they don't, you know, they don't.
So violet glass is what you hold the product in. It's not. Yeah, it's not in the plastic. Yeah,
no plastic, because essential oils will leach into plastic. So the violet glass is used, to keep them safe and secure.
Yeah, I think that's really important, because we had a health fest at our church in October, and I made turmeric shots and I made ginger shots. But I sold them in small plastic, in small glass vials. And
yeah.
Like, well, you can get them on Amazon. You can get them in plastic. And I'm like, me, got all my products from the farmer's market, all organic. And you want me to put that into, nah, it's going into a glass bottle. So, you know, and I've been asked, and it's something that I may start to do on a more regular basis, you know. And again, I am one of the things I wanted, because my juicer broke the week before my birthday. So I've had a couple of juices and they broke. And I'm like, right, it's between the Curvens and the Nama 2. And so I just put in my group to my friends and my family, like, I want, you know, I'm just looking for some help towards my juicer. And I got my Nama 2 last Thursday. And it, honestly, it's just, it changes your life.
I can imagine.
And it's like just the quality of the juice, just the extraction of the juice, just the dryness of it, and much, you know, the pulp. I think it's really important to understand for women as well, to understand that, you know, when I do these 60-day journeys, and when I've worked with my clients before with Empowering Lives, I had an Empowering Lives group when we was in lockdown. And, you know, to know that like juicing cleanses the blood, but smoothies energize the blood. Mm. And a lot of people find that quite hard to sort of fathom. They find it hard to, you know, I've got juice for what, 10 days. Well, I can't eat no food. And it's like, you were supposed to chew your drinks anyway, so you can eat your juice, right? Mm. So it's just a different way of chewing. But I think, you know, for some people, they just need that reset and that cleanse in terms of, you know, fertility. And there is a journey to be had. So let me ask you, since we're going into week two anyway, so I'm going to share this again. What doesn't get onto the first show, which you definitely won't all get on, then I'll just share. But let's look at the emotional thing as well. And, you know, when it came to then, you know, finding those products, making those products, you know, how did losing not just one baby, but two, how did that impact your relationship, and how is your relationship now? Because I think this is where the challenge comes in. And I think it's not just it's a massive thing for both of you.
Yeah.
And if the communication isn't where it needs to be, and the relationship doesn't have the strength that it needs for the journey, especially a journey like this, then what were the challenges you found, if you don't mind me asking? What challenges you found?
So I think for me, where I struggled, my partner had a young child. I mean, I struggled emotionally anyway, but he had a young child, beautiful, beautiful child. And so each time I would lose my child, I'm coming home. He would stay with us at the weekends, and I'm coming home to this young, beautiful baby who wasn't mine, you know? So that in itself played a real toll on my mind. I remember saying to God, why? And if you can imagine me sort of like falling to my knees, like, why? You know, I laugh about it now, but it definitely wasn't a laugh matter at the time. And I really struggled with this young child. And I remember distinctly this one day, Jenny, I just want to share with you, that I was in my room and I was crying, trying to compose myself, get myself ready to come out of the room so I could go down and spend some time with my stepson. And I literally sat at the top of the stairs. I could only do it in stages. So I left the room, sat at the top of the stairs, get to the middle of the stairs, like, the bottom of the stairs.
Yeah.
I just trying to, because the thing is, he was so young at the time as well. He'd visit us the weekend, but he'd miss his mum, as young children do, right? So there'd be days, times that he might not be as welcoming, let's just say, right? Mm. So this particular day, I sat down beside him and he just kind of looked at me. And I thought, Lord, I don't have it in me for this child to kind of just be offish or just not really want to speak to me today, because I don't have it in me, you know? And he looked at me again. He put his little toy down. He had like an action figure. And if you can imagine, almost like a little two-year-old, arms are probably only so long. He put his little arms around me. I hadn't said anything. I hadn't spoken to him. He hadn't said anything to me. And he held me with like what felt like ages. And it's literally, I just said, God, you must have told him that I've lost the baby.
Yeah.
That literally was my bond. It almost kind of like I melted in his little arms, and it kind of made it easier for me to kind of reconnect with him again.
Beautiful.
But needless to say, I was suicidal after my second loss. I distinctively remember it just got too much. I felt as though I tried everything. I felt as though I'd done every diet, every fad, you know, starved myself, drank every fluid, taken multivitamins. I felt as though I had done everything, you know, the IVF to have a child, and it just wasn't happening. And I remember sitting in my car and I just thought, okay, how do we do this? You know, and I revved the engine as I faced this wall and I thought, okay, cool. You literally, in your mind, you're trying to work out how you're going to do it to make sure you don't get maimed, but you actually
You've got to go.
It's the most horrendous, and literally God just placed my mum in my thoughts at that time, because we're very, very close. And you know, not wanting to labour here for too long, but cut long story short, I just spent more time with God. He literally just got me through that dark time. I don't know how. I think I cried just every day. But what I did do was, because my family were struggling, I kind of put on a brave face. So when I was crying, I'd always do it in private. I wouldn't let them know that I was broken, because I felt as though, as kind of like the matriarch of my family, I kind of felt as though as I was breaking, that they too was breaking. And I really recognized it was impacting my whole entire family. So I just one day said, look, guys, it is what it is. We've got to move forward and just not look back. Let's just, you know, crack on. Wow. And so I started to see almost like a sunflower. When you see the head of a sunflower rise in the morning,
that's up and, yeah,
literally what I saw them do. And in my own private time, I would just break.
Yeah, that's,
you know,
wow. So, and I think that's really, really important. So from that time to starting the Safe Space workshops, what was the trigger for those as well?
Well, my marriage broke down in the end. And so we got divorced in 2019. It broke down in 2018, got divorced in 2019. I began having counselling. I was offered counselling at the time with losses, and I just thought, it's not for me. That folk don't really do counselling. And I just also thought the person that they were kind of recommending were white people, and I just, you know, no disrespect, of course, but I thought, I don't think you're going to understand
the black experience.
Yeah, you're not going to get the black experience. You don't understand my culture. So I just thought, you know, I just probably wouldn't, you know. But then when I had the divorce, and interestingly, it wasn't I don't feel as though it was a divorce why I went for the counselling. Well, I know it wasn't a divorce why I went for the counselling, but it just kind of felt as though it was that compound effect of just everything. You know, and there's a friend of mine just said, the same friend that you know on the panel, she said, have you thought about going for counselling, and maybe you should give it a go? And I was like, okay, I don't really think I need it, but I'll go. And I remember distinctively kind of going into the my first session, sitting down saying, look, I don't really need counselling, but hey, let's just do this.
Let's just get it over and done with.
Yeah, let's just get it over and done with. Because I just felt there was such a taboo around counselling. I kind of felt that counselling was for people who would do. It wasn't for somebody who had, you know, experienced loss. Little did I know how life-changing counselling really is, because I was able to speak openly to someone who didn't know me, you know, because I realised that I couldn't speak to my family.
Was the counsellor a white person or a white black person?
No, it was a black woman, and she was a Christian. So it was
ticking
for me, you know. Because what I recognized that my family is so loving that every time I try to speak to them about how I was feeling, you could just kind of see them like, no,
listen. They want to hear. Listen, I've been in a similar situation, so I kind of understand. And I remember when I was in hospital and I had a social worker. It was a white lady. And I didn't really think about my culture or my colour. I just know it was someone who didn't know me. So when I shared, they didn't judge me.
Yeah.
And they just asked me questions that allowed me to answer them for myself. Mm. And I found her a lifesaver. I understand, you know, sometimes we have that culture thing and sometimes we think, well, they don't understand my blackness and the black struggle and the black experience and the black culture and, you know, whatever else. But it is quite interesting because my son's father left when I was pregnant, my oldest son, and he's never seen his father. But, you know, my son is 30 now. To this day, my family have never asked me about that man.
Mm.
And that, at the time, you know, it's only in recent years when I started to do empowering lives and doing my stuff to empower women and this thing that God gave me, finally free to forgive. And that's the workshop I'm running, you know. It was like, this is madness because mm-hmm. you're now, you might want to talk, but you can't because they're not willing to hear it.
Yeah.
They're not willing to deal with it. So now you've got to internalize it, but you don't realize the impact, the internalization of, because this is a big thing, right?
Yeah.
Like I've had a baby and the man ain't around. Like yeah. you know, you should be asking where the bloody hell's the geezer. And you're not asking me a single question, right? So I can't, it's like you're waiting for me to share and I'm waiting for you to ask.
Mm.
And I'm thinking to myself, the more you're not asking, I'm thinking, are you that detached? So there's a whole thing there again in the culture. And it's like, you know, when, you know, I tried to kill myself before I did. And then when the ambulance came, it was all like, oh, you're going to bring shame on the house. What are the neighbor's going to think? It's like, hello.
Yeah.
Just tried to kill myself.
Wow.
I didn't think about my neighbors. Do you know what I mean? It's like, yeah, you don't hear. Hello. You know, it's a real, and you go from that stuff there to now being this person that can, because you have a level of empathy, right? You've been through something, so you have a level of empathy. So you're able, so this lady has been a godsend for you. Yeah. And how did you turn that into?
So I had six sessions with her, because I think at the time I was like, that was what I needed at the time. And it was amazing. And I think when I began, as I mentioned, I kind of began speaking to women and just sharing my story and then recognizing that actually I wasn't alone. You know, there were so many more women out there going through exactly what I was going through, but none of us were speaking about it. And then I just decided that I'm going to begin to try and get women together. So I started doing these safe space, I call them workshops, for a better word. And we literally come together. Sometimes it's over food, you know, sometimes it's making skincare, but either way, it's something that brings people together. It's not a counseling session where we're sitting down, we're focused on talking about our discussion, our particular issue, but we are doing something that we do as women, right? So whether that's creating food or whatever it is, and then getting them to kind of open up collectively, because you know, when people don't know each other, it's hard for them to be open. So I do begin with kind of sharing my story, depending on whatever the topic might may be. And then kind of open the floor for them to share. And interestingly, every single one of them always share.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Stop suffering with pet-related allergies when near dogs and cats. Great news, you can feel safe around pets with Nasal Guard for pet lovers. Nasal Guard topical gel blocks pet dander, hair, and dust mites from entering your nasal passages. Try Nasal Guard for pet lovers today. Visit Amazon or nasalguard.co.uk to learn more about Nasal Guard spray and gel products. Again, that's nasalguard.co.uk.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries
and cream. A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
So in light of World COPD Day, we are speaking about respiratory health. And I am blessed to be speaking with Professor Michael Crooks, who is a respiratory physician and academic working in Hull York Medical School, University of Hull, and Hull University Teaching Hospitals and NHS Trust. So Professor Michael, welcome to Her Health and Happiness.
Thank you very much. And thank you for the opportunity to talk about respiratory health today.
Yeah, no, it's my pleasure. Do you know, it's interesting because I think when we look at health, when we look at,
well, that's something we don't think about so much. So why do you think that is?
Yeah, I think that I suppose the impact and burden of lung disease is often underestimated and certainly doesn't get the same recognition as other common conditions like cancers or cardiovascular disease. But clearly, respiratory health is very important. Respiratory disease is the third leading cause of death in England. And unfortunately, our outcomes for people with respiratory disease are among the worst in Europe. So there's clearly a lot that we need to do to raise awareness and by doing that, help to improve the outcomes that we see for people living with lung disease in the UK.
Yeah, but I mean, the thing is, even just trying to raise awareness, would that be, are we looking at environmental factors? Are we looking at nutrition and lifestyle factors? Are we looking at stress factors? What is it, do you think, is contributing?
Well, I think that there are many complex factors which contribute to the outcomes that we see within the UK. I think that the environment is, of course, important and lifestyle also very important. And I think we generally need to recognise the impact that lung health and I suppose the lack of lung health and lung disease has in order to have a coherent strategy to then addressing that, both from prevention through diagnosis and treatment.
I think when it comes to respiratory health, it is funny because obviously without your lungs, you don't have anything. Your heart, your lungs, they're just a team working together. And we can look at all different areas of health, but 3 minutes without oxygen, the brain starts to die. If we have and our nutrition is carried around, obviously, in the blood, pushed around by the oxygen. So respiratory health should be something that's at the forefront, because if you can't breathe well, the body doesn't function well.
Absolutely. And I think we very much take breathing for granted, don't we? It's not even a conscious process for the vast majority of us. And that's, of course, how it should be for everyone. But for people living with lung diseases like asthma or COPD, who often experience breathlessness when doing normal day-to-day tasks, it becomes a very isolating thing to experience. The more breathlessness you experience, the less you tend to do. You try and avoid things that make you breathless. And as a result, some people living with lung disease really can feel quite hidden. And so it's really important that we bring these things to the fore. And it was interesting that you mentioned that link to cardiovascular health, because in fact, with COPD, particularly, we're increasingly recognizing the association between COPD and risk of cardiovascular disease as well. So it's really important that we tackle the lung health to also help to ensure cardiovascular health.
Yeah. So can we just, Professor Michael, can we just let the listeners know a bit more about what is COPD? What are the sort of root causes as such that people may have that they don't realize may develop into something like COPD?
Yeah, absolutely. And you're certainly not alone in COPD not being a well-known condition, despite it affecting over a million people in the UK. And a lot of people are living with COPD who haven't been diagnosed, so completely unaware of it. So COPD stands for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and it's a progressive lung condition that affects adults and is associated with symptoms like breathlessness, cough, and phlegm. And people with COPD are often prone to getting episodes acutely where symptoms get significantly worse and can then lead to needing healthcare, either in primary care or attending the emergency department to being treated in hospitals. Now, COPD can have a number of causes. In the UK, the most common reason for developing COPD is smoking, but that's not exclusively the case. But certainly, if we can address and tackle smoking and help people to stop smoking earlier in life, and that would help to prevent COPD for a large number of people.
Mm. And I think, I suppose, yeah, if you look at, like you said, over a million people are living with this disease. But when you look at it in relation to the overall population of, let's say, 60 or 70 million, it's like a small percentage. But everyone has something. And if we don't actually look at the proliferation of that, 1 million could very easily become 2 million, 10 million. 15 million in 10, 20 years' time, couldn't it? So that would be a challenge number one. But then that burden that it puts onto the NHS, how are we able to tackle that burden better? So that, because I think what we need to do as individuals is look at ways in which we can actually optimize our own health, as opposed to not really paying attention to the things that we're doing that contributing to poorer health and then actually becoming a burden. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it does. I think there's probably a few points there. So I think the first is absolutely. I suppose the 1.2 million people that the statistics say are diagnosed with COPD seems a relatively small proportion of the whole population. But in fact, there are probably several more million people living with COPD who just haven't been diagnosed yet, and as a result are living with the symptoms of it and the experience, but not then able to access the treatment. So it's really important that we address that. And I think the other thing to be clear about is the impact that COPD has. So COPD is the second most common reason for hospital hospitalizations in the UK. So its impact on healthcare is quite significant. And of course, the economic impact, therefore, so the cost to the NHS of treating COPD is again significant and largely impacted then by the healthcare use. So if we can help people to one, reduce their risk of developing COPD, but of course for those that have developed the symptoms to get a diagnosis and be treated effectively, then we can significantly reduce that impact, both on the individual in terms of symptoms and quality of life, but also then on the NHS and wider society.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very powerful point. I think what you just said there as well, 1.2 million may seem like a drop in the ocean compared to 70 million. But if it's the second biggest admission for hospitals, then suddenly that small speck now becomes like a massive oak tree, doesn't it? It becomes a much bigger issue in terms of looking at hospital spaces, looking at hospital occupation, looking at hospital budgets. It suddenly becomes something that, yes, it may be 1.2 million, but if it significantly impacts the NHS as a whole, then to overlook it would be is quite detrimental.
Absolutely. And of course, the impact on the individuals who are experiencing it and their families can also be quite dramatic. You know, when you live with breathlessness, that then stops you going out to do your own shopping, or you find it difficult getting washed and dressed, then of course, you know, that has a really significant and profound impact on individuals and families. Often people aren't able to work or retire early as a result of having COPD. And as a consequence, the knock-on effects are fairly...
Quality of life.
Yeah,
the quality
absolutely.
Of life is taken away. I mean, for me, I love my tennis. I play tennis. I cycle. I do these things. So I specialize in female intimate health. And I say to, you know, my clients and to my audiences when I speak that, you know, so many things you take for granted, like you mentioned, you know, the inability to dress yourself well, to get up the stairs, even that's going to affect the quality of your sleep, because you're not going to be able to have that good, proper, deep quality sleep that you need to repair and restore and rebuild and refresh, because, you know, the breathlessness is going to interrupt the sleep rhythms, the circadian health, and so it has such a knock-on effect. But and it will shorten lifespan and quality of life. And I think until quality of life is taken from other people, they don't really respect or understand what quality of life really means.
Yeah, I think it's some really good points there, and clearly, you know, the impact of identifying, I suppose, the conditions earlier and ensuring people can access and diagnosis early, where we can make the necessary changes to try and improve long term outcomes with these conditions, so you can live healthier for longer with these conditions. Of course, you know, the better. So I think, you know, prioritizing, of course, trying to prevent these conditions from developing in the first place, but also really encouraging if anyone listening thinks that they may have symptoms that would be in keeping with one of these conditions, you know, don't put off seeking help, because if we can help to get an early and accurate diagnosis for you, and to give you the advice about how to best maintain your lung health and get you on the right treatments, then we can improve symptoms, improve quality of life, and improve these outcomes, which of course we've talked about in terms of hospital admissions and mortality.
So is that the aim of COPD? COPD Day, got to get that right, and it's COPD Day.
The World COPD Day is very much around about raising awareness, prompting these kind of conversations where we can discuss the challenges that people with COPD face, and how we can help to address them. And I think that it's really about trying to have that discussion and awareness so that people can start to think about, well, how can we prevent COPD? How can we allow people to access early and accurate diagnosis? How can we ensure that people with diagnosed conditions access effective evidence-based treatments? I think it's also really important that we emphasize the need to continue to learn more and invest in research and innovation so that we can continue to understand better how to most effectively treat COPD and, of course, other lung conditions.
Yeah. So can I ask you, Professor Michael, do you look at nutrition and lifestyle? How does that blend in with, there is definitely a place and a time and a platform now for the NHS and holistic healthcare to come together, because, you know, we are what we eat, we are what we think, we are what we breathe, we are what we drink. So that all those things that we're taking in, you know, the different types of stresses, the thermal stresses, the electromagnetic field stresses, the chemical stresses, all of those things must play their role. So how do, and obviously the other question I wanted to ask you as well is, this is not a, I think some people look at some diseases and illnesses as being sort of age related, but this can affect children as well as adults, can't it? So how are we trying to maybe raise awareness in terms of even the choices that we're making as individuals? And recognizing those choices can have an impact on our own health and vitality.
So certainly lung disease can affect anyone at any stage of life. I suppose thinking about asthma as another common lung disease would typically be something that would affect children, young adults, and of course through all stages of life. COPD tends to be something that affects adults, and is due to that cumulative exposure over time that leads to lung injury leading to COPD. But you're absolutely right that lifestyle and the environment that we live in is an important factor in improving outcomes for people with lung disease and indeed in preventing lung disease. And I suppose when we're talking about conditions affecting the lungs, the air that we breathe is very important. The air quality is very important. And of course, what we put in our lungs in terms of smoking and such like also being important factors. So a major factor is about trying to support people who smoke to be able to stop that, and also be able to provide advice about air quality and exposure to things that can worsen lung disease. So some people with asthma, for example, it can be triggered by pollens and things like that. So giving information about how to avoid those kind of triggers can be helpful in management. Nutrition, I think, is also an important thing. So we know that people with COPD who, in fact, are underweight, which can be a feature in people with more advanced COPD, have worse outcomes. So again, ensuring that people maintain a healthy diet and a healthy weight can be very important in optimizing their management. So it is key to look at, of course, treatment and treating people as a whole, and all the elements that impact them, and those lifestyle factors like activity, so keeping fit and active is also very important in improving lung health, as well as thinking about the more healthcare interventions that we can do to help. All of those things have to go hand in hand.
I've run out of time. I have run out of time. In fact, I've run over time, but I really hope this made sense, because there's so much more to getting pregnant, staying pregnant, and actually the mental, emotional, conversation that we shared at the beginning, that Lisa shared and that I also shared about my journey and that conversation, because mentally and emotionally at the time you don't realize what it's doing to you, but it's what it does in the future, how you hold on to it and how it shows up later. That's the difference. When it comes to COPD, remember respiratory issues, it's the respiratory diaphragm and the pelvic diaphragm that work hand in hand. So that this is an important interview for us, because we have to understand that respiratory issues can become pelvic floor issues just like that. So if you have any questions, you want to ask me any questions, remember it's pelvicsecrets@icloud.com. You can find me at Pelvic Secrets on Instagram, social media, or Jenny Russell on LinkedIn. But until next week, because I'm going to get murdered, I need to wrap up. But remember, let your inner world reflect the thoughts you have, and those things that you're looking for, they will come to you in health and happiness. Stay blessed, stay safe.